Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. This is your host, Murtada, and I'm here with my co-host,
Nathaniel, that's me.
And our other film experience friend, here is Chris File.
Hi, guys.
Chris, you haven't been on in a long time.
I know. I'm happy to be back. I'm happy to be back discussing what we're discussing today. It's two things I like.
Well, we brought you on specifically because you have a different viewpoint of Midsommar.
I seem to be in the top, like, 5% of people who love this movie. And, like, I saw it again yesterday, and I can confirm I truly do absolutely love this movie as much as I do. But, yeah, so, like, I'm kind of the extreme positive.
Well, that's good. It'll be a mix of opinions.
Yes.
Which you guys you're more in the middle, right? Both of you guys are not as negative as I have seen from some folks.
I'm in the middle, but I'll let Nathaniel explain himself.
I'm vacillating a bit. This isn't the only movie we'll be discussing, but since it's the topic du jour, Midsommar is the new horror film from Ari Aster, who you previously saw his debut, Hereditary. So, it's another one of those horror movies that people like to call elevated horror, which is so annoying.
Yeah.
But it's much different than Hereditary, even though at the beginning it felt to me that it was going to be another study of grief in a way. Because the setup for it is this young woman who experiences this trauma in her life, and then she decides to go on vacation of sorts with her boyfriend and to observe rituals for the summer solstice in this remote village in Sweden. And since it's a horror movie, as you can guess, things quickly progress to from creepy to terrifying. But no,
because of the pagan cult.
Right, but
we
should say it's really hard to talk about this movie with spoilers. So I do intend to totally use spoilers. So if you haven't seen it, please wait until you do to listen, because we can't really discuss it without spoilers, correct?
Without, like, going deep, if you go any deeper into really the themes of it, it's hard to really kind of dance around it without, like, yeah.
So, yeah, we're just going to totally spoil everything, so this is your warning. What were you singing there, Murtada?
I'm just singing my spoilers song. I love spoilers. I even like spoilers before seeing movies.
You do?
Yes, I don't care about spoilers. They do not actually, like, make me enjoy the movies less. I'm fine. Spoil it away.
Chris hasn't
spoiled, actually, Midsommar for me, but he did text me a couple of things, and it made me just more excited to see the movie.
I don't think I've experienced a movie where people want to be spoiled as much as this one, because I've had a lot of questions about the gore in this movie, if people thought that they could handle it. Like, in a way, I think people were not fully prepared for, like, what the movie actually is, even though the trailers are essentially the entire third act of the movie.
I haven't watched the trailer, actually.
It doesn't necessarily, like, prepare you for, like, what the tone of this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've also talked to a lot of people who think that the movie's not very scary. I wasn't very scared by it. If anything, I think it's more of a dark comedy. Even though, I mean, it's a horror movie. I'm not going to be one of those people that, you know, like you mentioned, the elevated horror thing that's annoying. But very, very strange movie. One that even though I've seen twice, I'm still wrapping my head around it.
I actually laughed through all of the gore. I just thought it didn't look real at all. You know, when they're decapitating bodies and heads are split open by hammers. I just thought it all wasn't visceral at all. And it was just funny. I laughed through all of those scenes.
I thought it was very funny, but not that. I was one of those people who I have trouble with gore. I was covering my face several times during this movie, as Murtada can attest, because we saw it together.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching through fingers a lot of it.
It's also one of those movies, at least with the gore and the violence, it's prepping you for it. So if you're somebody who's squeamish to gore, like, you're going to know when to close your eyes in this movie.
Yeah, and I did. I will give it that. Like, it gives you a long... We'll talk about the pacing in a second, but it generally prepares you well in advance that you're about to see something horrific.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the... You mentioned that you felt like it looked... The gore looked fake. How did you actually feel about the environment? Because one of the things that I love about the movie is it kind of works in the opposite way of Hereditary, in that, like, one of the things that I found most terrifying and unnerving about Hereditary is everything looks so stagey. It never looks like a real house. Like, it almost looks like you're watching, like, when you go see a play of a house and it's, like, somewhat abstracted, but it doesn't actually look like people live there. That's what Hereditary felt like to me.
Mm-hmm.
And in Midsommar, the sequences in the first act that are in America still felt like stagey that way. Like, it looked like a piece of stagecraft. But then,
yeah, I
when
mean,
they go to
what
Sweden,
other bar,
it's very tactile. You know, like, it felt real.
Yeah, I mean, what other bar is so quiet? Like, the bar that they go to before. It's, like, so quiet, and you hear every word. Yeah, nothing, it felt stage everywhere. It's just nothing felt real, which is, I guess, is part of his aesthetic, right? Because the whole thing when they go to Sweden is not supposed to be real, or maybe it's real only if you are on mushrooms.
But, Chris, aren't you saying it felt real to you once they got...
It did. And some of that is because they're literally on an actual hillside, but I think what he's doing here is working in a much more natural environment, and even those, like, because it's essentially this Swedish village, those were built sets, and it's like they feel like an architect would have designed them to those rooms to exist like they did. I guess maybe I'm not explaining it all that well, but, like, that was one of the things that was unnerving to me, because he set up this movie to, I guess, mirror what your experience was with Hereditary in terms of the space that the actors were in and the set design, and it ends up being something much more open, and, like, you feel like the actors are able to exist in this real space instead of one that's heightened. Even though it's got all these paintings, and that was unexpected for me. I was expecting it to be much more abstract in this environment.
Well, as the only one of us who has lived in Scandinavia, and I also lived above the Arctic Circle and experienced the situation where it only gets dark for a couple hours, and that darkness is no darker than, like, dusk. So in that way, I was very familiar with what the movie was doing, and time, like, the thing where they go into the building and they have to, like, shutter all the windows in that communal sleeping space, that's all very, that happens. Like, if you live there, you have heavy curtains or whatever for the summer, because you can't, it never feels like nighttime. So you're... Mm-hmm. If you're not used to it, which I wasn't, it can be very unnerving. So in that way, I appreciated that, because I hadn't really seen that in a movie, or not a movie that I can recall. But I, having also lived in Norway for a while and been above the Arctic Circle, it also didn't, you know, it just didn't, I never bought it, because, you know, it just seem like this weird exoticization of something that isn't really creepy. Like, the sort of, like, I've seen people wear costumes like that because, you know, national holidays and things like that in Norway. I mean, it's not Sweden, but close enough. And it's just not a creepy place, which is why it's so funny to me that there's this whole genre of, like, a Swedish horror and, you know, all this stuff, because it's just not... Scandinavia is just not creepy, at least to me.
But, I mean, the creepiness in this movie is supposed to come from, like, the sound design, which I think was the best element about it. And it's sort of... It comes from... He's doing what I think he's doing is that he's presenting something that's supposed to be innocuous in sunlight, community of people who are supposed to be all about love and whatever,
right.
and sort of digging deeper to tell you all the sort of psychological things that drive them to do what they do. From that perspective, I did find it creepy, mostly because of his sound design. Like, I thought that really brought the creepiness to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But a question that I have for you, Chris, since you love this movie, he is obviously gifted visually.
Mm-hmm.
But how deep are his ideas? Like, what ideas in this movie were you turned on? Because I really can't find anything. There is a little bit at the beginning of sort of like grief and being in a terrible relationship that you want to leave, but you can't leave off. And that was sort of like a little bit of the funny part. But like, I thought it was a little bit surfacey and not very deep. And I don't know what he was trying to tell us.
I kind of question how deep he wants to be, and I'm kind of fine with that, because I felt this. I had a lot of people ask me that question about Hereditary too, and I'm fine if he's just got a lot of ideas and not like super depth, because that's not what he's chasing. I think this is at least more deep than Hereditary. I just don't think he's spoon feeding a lot of it to us. I think there's a lot about, you know, the tradition that it's depicting is about, like, cycles of life and, like, the winter, the spring, the summer, and the fall of everything. And I think he's making a horror movie that's essentially about relationships can be that way, and sometimes you need to embrace endings, such as the relationship in this film that is dreadful. There's stages of grief. I think this is less of a movie about grief than Hereditary is. I think there's a lot of ideas at play in this. I don't know if I can give you like the one that I think I connect with. I definitely think he's mirroring, like, a lot of people talk about how this is a breakup movie. I think
that's what he said, though. That's what he keeps saying in every interview.
I definitely think it is too, especially if you've been in one of those like shit relationships that, you know, it's essentially like an exorcism getting out of it. I think It's not enough focused on Danny to say that it is essentially a character piece, but I see a lot of the work of Von Trier in this, in just like what her arc is and what the emotional arc, and some of the complications of it, because most of the movie we're watching her sublimate herself, and we're watching her, you know, pacify the group to the point where she doesn't have her own identity and she doesn't really have her own sense of community. And to kind of like expunge herself from this toxic situation, she does find this community in this group that does embrace her. But it's also like they're killing people, right? So it's like when you're looking for comfort and community because you don't have it, what do you make yourself vulnerable to?
I think a lot of those ideas are interesting, but I just felt it was kind of all over the place. I see what you're saying, and from your review, which I really liked, I really like reading in-depth reviews that I don't agree with. Like, I don't understand why more people don't seek those out. You know, people are always like, oh, I trust that critic because they agree with me. And I'm like, that's just dumb because what are they? But I just didn't feel it ever focused on any one of those things, or that it wasn't quite convincing me that that was what it was about. Like, I sort of bought into your argument about toxic relationships, except for I noticed when I was discussing it with Matata after the movie that I actually think Danny is toxic from the start. It's not just, and whereas I think most people who take that reading are viewing the boyfriend as the problem, and yes, he is an asshole. But
the best asshole.
Yeah, but I like, but he's kind of a he's unself-aware, and she also is, but I think they're both completely toxic, because she's one of these people, like, I've known people like this in real life. It's like an energy vampire. Like, even when she's trying to be chill, she makes it all about herself.
Mm-hmm.
With her protestations about no, I'm fine, and then everybody has to refocus on her. You know, and I thought she was a nightmare before, well before the nightmare began. And I just felt like he was in over his head, of course, but he was really a terrible boyfriend, too. So I kind of bought
that. Really cowardly, because he should have called it off, but, like, he doesn't know how to do anything. Like, you even, you see it in his personality throughout, too, because, like, the whole thing with his master's thesis,
yeah,
he can't even come up with his own idea. He has to usurp someone else's because essentially half of the work is already done, or at least the thought of it is.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, he also, in the end, when their friends that went on the trip with them are viewed as doing something wrong, he immediately throws them under a bus and he's like, no, I don't know anything about them. He's not only a bad boyfriend, he's like a terrible friend and a fucking asshole. He's just a terrible person.
Yeah.
No, but so, but my point is, if it was about a toxic relationship that she needed to get out of, he also clearly needed out of that relationship. That's what I'm saying. So I had a trouble viewing it as that, because I think it should have been maybe more sympathetic to her. But that could just be my own reading from my own history with people. We have all had troubled friendships or troubled relationships in our life.
Sure.
I mean, they both wanted to get out of... They both should have gotten out of the relationship, yes, for sure. But I think inherently he's just more of a terrible person, as sort of emphasized by his relationships to all the other characters. He's willing to steal from people, throw them under the bus, and even sort of his, what I loved in the performance, actually, and I actually think Jack Rayner is the best performance in the film, what I loved about it is sort of the physicality of it when he's trying but failing to express physical intimacy with his girlfriend, like the ways that he sort of like non-committally touches her shoulder when she is like feeling bad, or tries to hold her hand or come next to her whenever she like needs some support from her boyfriend. It's all, I was just like, oh my God, he's terrible at this.
And
he doesn't know what he's doing.
I agree with you that he's fantastic in the movie, and he's doing a lot of things that are incredibly nuanced like that, that are not like, not the type of things we necessarily pay attention to, but it makes the relationship believable on screen, even like those little minutia things that we may or may not notice in like the relationship building between the actors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, I really just did not like this movie. Part of the problem for me was the pacing, and I'm curious, since you've seen it twice, like how the pacing struck you, because I heard the complaint about Hereditary a lot, that it was too slow and nothing happened till the end type of thing, but Hereditary for me totally worked, and I thought the pacing brought up all this dread, because things always felt off from the beginning, which I think the movie has a brilliant opening with, like, the dollhouse stuff. Whereas this, it feels off from the beginning, but it never goes anywhere that you don't see coming a mile away. So, like,
and I guess that this could be frustrating, and like this is like a like forehead slapper for some people, but like I do think that's partly the point in making a movie about like a relationship that's doomed to fail. Like the writing has always been on the wall for this, and like that's going to make for a frustrating viewing experience for some people. But like, you know, the opening like mural, I guess, or the drawing, it's literally, when I watched it again the second time, I paid closer attention to it and not like, oh, look at this cool drawing. It's literally the plot of the movie. And like specific things that happen that, like, if we said it on this podcast right now, we would be like, that's a spoiler. But no, I think that's partly the point of it. But like, you say that it's slow and boring and obvious.
I didn't say boring.
Oh, okay. I had a lot of people use the B word about this movie.
I was not bored, ever. Mm-hmm. But I just was... It was just so, like, the pacing was dreadfully slow for me, because I could always see where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, if you're doing this movie about an inexorable situation, and, like, you know, you're trying to build, like, tension, which I'm sure he was...
Mm-hmm.
You have to, if you know where it's going and the point is it's inevitable, then speed it up. Like, I just felt really, it was testing my patience. It reminded me a lot of, and, you know, please forgive me to everybody who thinks this movie is terrible, because Midsommar is a much better movie, but Under the Silver Lake. Because it's another director where they are clearly visually talented. They clearly have a lot of visual ideas, but it's just, like, so indulgent. It's like, edit yourself. Like, I know you had a big success. That doesn't mean every idea you have or every shot should be held for 5 minutes. You know, I was just very frustrated watching it because, like, it felt like it was 3 hours long to me, and I knew where it was going at all times.
I actually agree with you, Nathaniel. I thought the pace was very slow, and yes, it's a horror movie. There is no need for it to be almost 2.5 hours. Like, you get, you know, I don't want to say I was bored, because I wasn't, but also I was, like, ready for it to end, or ready to get the jolts I was promised. Mm-hmm. So there is no need for the first jolt to come in 40 minutes into a horror movie. Like, give it to me, dude. Why were we here for 40 minutes before we're jolted in a horror movie? Or why do we need to wait another hour before we get another jolt? And what's with all the walking about? There were so many scenes where they're just walking. What the fuck? Like, it's not that compelling, this just walking about. Anyway.
Yeah, so the pacing was the big turnoff for me, and also that I just wasn't surprised, which, and even some of the humor, like, even some of the more satirical elements, or what I saw as satirical, didn't really work for me, because the movie wasn't shaped around them. Like, for instance, when two of the characters want to do their thesis on these rituals, summer solstice and this little town, so they're interviewing the people, and one of them asks about their laws about incest, because you're in this super remote village, like, how do you avoid incest, you know, with all these generations there? And one of them says, oh no, we're, you know, we totally respect that taboo. And then it's like two scenes later, I think, where somebody says, oh no, we purposely use incest to create our oracles.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was like, the juxtapositions of those scenes should have been tighter or something, to show sort of the sort of hypocrisy or the sort of there were so many things in the movie that felt like ideas that just weren't shaped, because the whole thing felt so, like, lumpy to me.
That, to me, what I picked that up on was that they were not actually a true, like, cult organization. They were taking, there's other pieces too where it's like, oh, this rune is like this language, and they're like, no, that's not what it is, this is ours.
Yeah.
Where they're essentially a fraud cult, basically. That was at least my interpretation of it.
Oh, and I would say one other thing that really, really irritated me, since I'm the person who likes at least in this room, is this is something I think would have made the movie much more fascinating, and I'm curious about it in a retrospect, since you've seen it twice.
Mm-hmm.
The main Swedish character is friends with Danny and her boyfriend before they go to Sweden. Mm-hmm. So, like, as the movie progresses, you start to realize that he has sort of engineered the situation to bring them people to kill. Right? Mm-hmm. Spoilers, as we said. So, but even that was, like, even though he seems shady right away, and I could sort of see where that was going, even that wasn't shaped, because after a while I thought, oh, he wants Danny for himself.
Mm-hmm.
But I got no feeling of that or indication of that early in the movie. And I think that would have been a much more interesting, you know, to see that develop over the course of the movie, that maybe this was his game plan all along. But that just felt, even though I said I could see where everything was going, that element of it just sort of didn't work for me, even though I thought it was interesting. So did you see that early in the movie?
I definitely... Oh, go ahead, Murtala.
there was this one time where Danny was visiting all the friends, and he was the only one willing to talk to her, and wanted to talk to her about her tragedy and the loss that she was grieving at the time, where the other two friends, Will Poulter and the guy from The Good Place, James Harper, is that his
William
name?
William
Jackson Harper, are completely not interested in her and just think of her as this nuisance, that why are you here, while he was trying to talk to her. But I agree with you that it wasn't developed further than that. But you could see in the way he performed it in that scene that he's really interested in her.
Yeah, that he's like borderline flirting with her. I will also say his first line in the movie is, think of all of those Swedish girls you can impregnate. And he says that to Christian.
Ooh. Okay, well, that's good.
So
see, that's what I was curious about, seeing it a second time, if some of the things are planted early.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't mind spoilers, and I actually sometimes, not all times, don't mind movies telegraphing to me what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But since this movie does telegraph a lot, and to your point, Chris, you can see the plot on the movie visually laid out to you in the opening credits.
Yeah.
And your point, Nathaniel, about, like, you could always tell where it was going, that didn't bother me. But did it bother you guys? Because, like, I think part of being a sort of horror movie is to be jolted, and this movie didn't have that many jolts because you could totally see what's going to happen. Like that scene where the other prisoners, the ones who came from the UK with the other Swedish friend, and you know, it's a very funny scene where he's talking like, oh, I used to date this girl, and she's like, we went on one date and I only knew it was a date after the date ended. And you're like, ooh, he's gonna kill her. And so, and so it does tell you exactly what's gonna happen. So did that bother you guys?
I mean, it obviously bothered me.
Yeah. I think I cued into the fact that, like, everything that we were about to see would be representational of what a bad relationship is. So it's like all of these warning signs that you keep seeing. Like, it's like when you have those friends who it's like, oh, that weird comment they just made, that is going to cause a fight 2 weeks from now. It's like watching that type of thing unfold, which I guess is not going to be satisfying for a lot of people for a horror movie.
Well, see, I'm not...
But, like, no, it didn't bother me, though.
I'm not precious at all about horror movies. I'm totally okay with doing it however you want to do it. To me, it's just, like, if that's your topic, the inevitability and the toxicity or whatever, I'm like, it needs to be tighter, because then you need to feel like, oh, my God, get out, get out, get out. And it's hard to have those intense feelings when they're just, like, sort of wandering about the countryside.
Yeah,
at least for me.
I was at least cool with this movie being, you know, more of like this expressionist type of horror of, you know, this is what it feels like to liberate yourself from a terrible relationship, but like in the, like, wearing the costume of a folk horror quasi gore fest.
Yeah.
What I liked about the film, and this has nothing to do with the film, but there is good writing about it. The reviews have been interesting, and I know Nathaniel, you mentioned Chris's review, which is great, and everybody should read it. But another review that I really liked is from friend of the pod, Andrew Kendall. And he sort of wrote about how Ari Aster has no interest in the characters and no empathy for them at all. And he makes a good argument for that. Did you guys feel that he sort of kind of hated all the characters in the film?
I felt that, yes.
I did not think that he hated Danny. I definitely felt like, I mean, you read an interview, he'll tell you that he's Danny, but I definitely felt it, at least in, like, just the way she was framed, the emotional arcs of the movie, like, how her performance was able to evolve what the, like, I guess, emotional texture of the movie was. I felt like the movie was more on her side than anyone's, and it was all about showing how awful everyone else is. To Nathaniel's point, like, some of her behavior isn't all that great, but I do think, or maybe it's not that it's all that great, but, like, there are other perspectives on Danny's behavior in this movie too, but I think that the movie sides with her behavior, or
but
her
I mean,
experience, at least.
I mean, it does, but in the end, she's stuck being the queen of this stupid cult. Like, she's going to live like this for the rest of her life. I don't know if that's, like, a good ending.
I mean, see, that's another thing with it, too. It's, like, her transformation, if you will, which I did not buy, and I know you love the performance, and I love that actress from other mm-hmm. things that I've seen, but I just didn't get... I didn't buy it in the way, say, I bought... It has a very similar ending, spoilers, to The Witch.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to live deliciously? You know, because it has that same sort of, like, the person becomes very transgressive, and they feel liberated by doing that.
And the need to have a community of your own, et
yeah.
cetera.
So it's a very similar trajectory, but in The Witch, I bought it so much more. And, like, her... I was also a little confused at the ending about the ceremony, because at the very end of the movie, they have to kill, like... Or they have to bring all the bodies in and kill a few more, because there has to be a certain number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they say she has to choose somebody, but I don't recall her ever choosing somebody.
Well, she chooses that's her boyfriend.
She doesn't indicate, but, like, it's essentially cut away to, like, give us a laugh, basically. Like, of course she picked him, because it was either kill Christian or kill this nameless Swede who, I forget what his name is, but, like, there's this whole, visual gag of the, like, bingo token.
Yes.
Draw that person.
Yeah, to me, like, I don't know. Like, I didn't, I felt... see, again, it was a shaping thing.
Yeah.
The movie had so much flab on it that I didn't catch some of these things that you're seeing in it because they weren't close enough together or juxtaposed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like, to your point, Murtada, like, there is a lot of interesting writing about this movie, and I think it's because it draws up a wide range of differences and wide range of responses to even individual moments of the movie. Like, even Nathaniel, you're saying you feel like it's flabby, so it's not tight enough for you to catch those things. And for me, like, kind of the breathiness of this movie really heightened the absurdity of it and, like, his absurdist humor mm-hmm. And maybe that's why I'm like, it's really a dark comedy. Though I'm not going to be one of those people. So, like, yeah,
funny.
There's something about the length of this movie. And, like, for me, again, it, like, went very, like, I thought it was kind of breezy, even though you could feel the length of it. Something about that made the, like, creepy tone that he was going for that was really specific, that's unique, all more heightened, and also, like, the funnier elements, and the just, like, the drag of what a relationship like that is like. It really heightened all that for me.
I mean, let's talk about that ludicrous sort of orgy. I mean, I thought that was also funny because of how Jack Rayner plays it. Like, he has that look on his face, which I guess is part from the mushrooms he took, mm-hmm. and part because he just can't believe that he's having sex in front of all these people. And
yeah,
it's just
he signed up for weird sex, not weird sex.
I will say my biggest laugh in the entire movie is when that old woman goes behind him and starts pushing on his butt. I thought that was, like, hurry it up, which I was laughing the hardest I laughed in the whole movie because that's how I was feeling about the movie at this point. I'm like, come on, just, you know, climax.
End already. Yeah. That was like a meta moment.
Yeah, that moment killed me. I do think the movie is really funny, which is why, like, I don't hate it. I just dislike it. I admire it, but dislike it. That's my stance on it.
It's not fully a pleasant movie. Like, I think there's going to be more people that end up disliking it than liking it.
I just wish it was deeper. I don't know. Like, if you're going to make me spend 2 hours and 25 minutes exploring grief and bad relationships in a cult in Sweden, I wish you had more ideas beyond the surface level ideas. I wish it was deeper. That's all.
I think some of Ari Aster's deepest ideas are mostly how stupid we are as a species.
Yeah, I guess that's not deep enough for me.
Yeah.
That's, like, obvious.
Yeah.
Give me more Ari Aster.
Yeah.
But I would say something as somebody, the naysayer on Hereditary on this podcast, I hated that movie so much, I enjoyed this a little bit more than Hereditary, and actually a lot more than Hereditary. And the main reason that I enjoyed this movie more than Hereditary is I think it seamlessly weaves in the mythology that he's interested in from the beginning of the film. Like, the mythology is weaved in from the beginning. It's weaved in better. So I think he has grown. Where Hereditary, I spent an hour and a half thinking I'm dealing with Toni Collette, sort of domestic crisis, and I was really engrossed in that and loving it. And then in the last half hour, some Paimon bullshit started happening, and I'm like, "What the fuck?" So I think he's moving in the right direction.
Well, we'll see. Film number three will tell the tale,
which apparently will not be a horror film, as he has sold.
Okay. What else has happened in his life that the next movie is going to be about?
Well, we've had cults, we've had witches. The next movie will be werewolves in, I don't know, we did like Portland, we did Sweden. Where are we finding some werewolves? It's going to be like Tokyo werewolves.
We would love to hear your thoughts on Midsommar, because the response is all over the place, which is generally an indication that a movie is worth seeing. I would say, even though I dislike it, I would say you should see it.
Particularly this year, where there's so much stuff that's just falling flat and like people don't even care to see. Like, this is at least something to discuss.
Yeah, or things that are like fun and good sits, and then you forget about them like seconds later. That was like, neither of you saw this, but that was Spider-Man Far From Home for me. Like, I enjoy Spider-Man, sure, but I couldn't, I wasn't thinking about the movie at all the next day.
Hey.
So Nick used to have this rating, which I forget what it was called, but it was like he would rate things on the letter grade, but then he also has a VOR or something like that, where it's like a grade that's based on how much new the movie is doing and how essential it is to see. So a lot of movies will be like right in the middle on everything, but sometimes it'll be like a low grade and a very high grade on like what it's attempting. And so I would say Midsommar on that level, Midsommar is a must see. I just did not like it myself.
Yeah.
I did not explain that properly, but anyway.
I understood what you were saying, at least. It felt fresh in a way that other movies
ambitious.
Are not.
It was ambitious, which I appreciate. I just didn't think it was successful.
Also, it's such a terrible summer for movies. Like, there's nothing out there. You might as well go see Midsommar.
I was thinking about this, about the running time. Just one last thing on Midsommar. It was like, everybody's talking about the length, and even I, when I first saw that, was like, oh my god. But, like, remember the summers that were, like, a decade ago where every movie was 2.5 hours long? Especially all of the studio movies. Like, the Spider-Mans were 2.5 hours long. The Pirates of the Caribbeans were 2.5 hours long. Like, at least we can have Midsommar be the alternative.
I haven't seen any of those movies, though. I'm living life well.
Yeah. You're using your time wisely, unlike me.
Oh, so moving on to another movie about a problematic woman. Wild Rose.
Although much less complicated than...
Yes.
Than... What is her name? Danny in Midsommar.
Yes.
From Danny to Rose Lynn. Well, I will say this about Rose Lynn. Less complicated, but she didn't kill anyone.
Yeah. Or choose to kill anyone.
Yeah.
She's had someone killed. She might have, though. She might have.
Yeah, I don't know. It starts with her in prison. We don't know what she did to get there. Did they ever tell us that?
Yes,
she was smuggling heroin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So she's a musician in Glasgow, but she wants to be a country star in Nashville. And it is played by Jesse Buckley in the lead, and we have the delightful Sophie Okonedo, who's been mentioned a million times on the Film Experience podcast, coming back in the role of the boss, and then as the mother, I'm totally blanking.
Julie Walters.
Julie Walters.
So did you guys like this movie?
I did,
and like after it was over and I actually thought about it, I was like, maybe I shouldn't have liked it as much as I did, but I still do. I mean, you've seen this movie a dozen times before. You felt the same emotions at this movie a dozen times before. I think there's a few surprising elements towards the end, like a few like thematic things that maybe you haven't quite seen those ideas expressed before in this kind of movie. But I did really like it. I mean, you feel a lot of big feelings. There's a closing song that's incredible. Co-written by Mary Steenburgen.
Mary Steenburgen, Oscar winner Mary Steenburgen, might have a Best Original Song nomination coming up.
She better, too. It's a good song. Plus, we want Best Original Song nominee Mary Steenburgen.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's a great song.
That song was the only time I sort of snapped up to attention. And I think Yeah, it was too late because it wasn't the ending. And, you know, to Chris's point, it's a very familiar story. It's full of cliches. It's just like I was just rolling my eyes. She's an artist, so she's a free spirit who ignores the needs of her young children. Wow. She has a tenuous relationship with her disapproving mother. Oh, God, we saw that. She has a benevolent boss who becomes her one true supporter. I'm like, oh, please save
me. Every step of the way is just touched by magic to get her on her way. Like, yes, yeah, it's very that. It is very that, like, the musical sequences are all completely disconnected from one another. This movie has, like, no musical identity, though maybe that's partly the point. I don't know. But, like, Jessie Buckley is so wonderful.
Yeah, I loved her, too. Murtada did not love her.
I loved her performance. I will say there's some script things that are a little head-scratchy that don't make sense, that don't... I guess maybe I didn't fully buy it, but I didn't think that was the performance's fault. Like, this woman, under no circumstances, was even accidentally smuggling heroin. It's not that bad. Like, I don't know.
Let me tell you why I didn't love the performance. I thought that in every scene, the writing, the direction, how it's filmed, everything was yelling at me, isn't she a star? Look at her. Isn't she a star? I was just like, can we relax a little bit? Let me get to that conclusion by myself without you trying and, you know, yelling loudly at me every single second she's on screen. Look at what she's doing. Look at how she sings. Look at how she walks. Look at how she cleans houses. I'm just like, okay, you're trying to make her a star. Thank you. I get the message.
I guess my question to that is kind of spoilery. So if listeners don't want Wild Rose spoilers either.
Although Wild Rose, you can't.
Yeah, I mean, you know what this movie is.
Yeah, you've seen it before.
Do you think that whole, like, look at her, she's a star aspect to it, which I agree with you, do you think that that is supposed to balance out the third act that says, no, she's not? Like, it's not like a bottom falling out, but, like, it is, like, a, like, coming down to earth a little bit.
Yeah, like, check yourself, you know, you have to earn stardom, all that stuff, yeah.
Maybe. I didn't think
of some authenticity too. Like this is what I actually like ultimately really liked about the movie, even if some of the details I found and some of the cliches not at all interesting, was that the movie is ultimately like we need to be more than our dreams, and we actually have to have some authenticity, and we have to actually earn some things, and we have to, you know, go through the hard experiences and actually learn from them. Dreams aren't enough. And that it could actually have that message while still being very hopeful.
Yeah, I like that about it, too.
Yeah, that's uncommon to me in this kind of movie.
Yeah, and to me, it's like a performance movie. So it all comes down to whether or not you like to see three actresses, like, at the center, which I do. And I thought all of them were very good, particularly Sophie Okonedo, who I know we've intoned many times, sometimes jokingly, but not because we don't like her. We love her. But, like, it's kind of an impossible character, right? She's this, like, rich woman who has this maid who she realizes can sing. And so she's suddenly, like, this patron of the arts, right? But I love the performance because to me, it read, even though it's not totally there in the script, for me, it read as, like, I totally got, oh, yeah, this is that woman. Like, she doesn't have a lot to do, and she latches onto an idea, and it's a way to, like, a way to liven up her own life. So she's, like, sort of, even though she's benevolent, she's basically using this other person to, like, entertain herself.
Yeah. I definitely got the sense that, like, her previous career was something in, like, truly project management where she could, like, control the moving pieces and, like, make meetings happen. And, like, it kind of reignited a professional side of her. That said, like, this character was fully, completely frustrating to me, and I would not have been on board with this storyline were it not for Sophie Okonedo being so wonderful.
Yeah,
I was not into this whole, like, my boss is going to get me a record deal story. It was like,
and then because I'm such a free spirit, of course I'm going to sabotage it. I'm just like, I knew that was coming a million miles away. I will not be held down by, like, you know, societal norms. I am such a free spirit.
My internal pain is going to make me screw this up, and I'm not going to ever tell anybody what that pain is until it's too late. However, like, the explosion scene I thought was really good, both for Jesse Buckley and Sophie Okonedo, who, like, Sophie Okonedo doesn't really get to say anything, but she has to process, like, all of these, like, lies and information and, like, realize what she herself has misled herself into. That scene was really interesting.
Yeah, but yeah, it wouldn't have been without Sophie.
Well, what did you guys think of Julie Walters in this movie? Because I thought she was very good, and not, again, like, to that thing where it's like, it's so much of what you expect, but in the one way that it is not makes it different, I guess, because I was expecting the typical, like, hard-suffering Julie Walters mother, but she is actually, like, brutally mean sometimes. Like, she has a harder edge than I have seen a Julie Walters performance have in a very long time that made the tension in the, made at least the tension of that relationship have, like, more, I don't want to say grit, but more, like, gravity to it than I was expecting.
I mean, I thought she was great, but I also thought it was the same performance she's been giving since Billy Elliot.
Yes.
They always give her the same part.
I think, but I think it's more tough than I was expecting, in a way that I was like, oh, these are, this is going to go to, like, past the point that I'm expecting these scenes to go, because, like, she's already long had those, like, more, like, accepting but, like, tough love moments. Like, this is fully, like, she's just done with her at all times.
Yeah, I love when she, like, refused to take care of the kids. I was like, oh, tough love grandmother. But yeah, I appreciated her, like, tough love moments where she just was like, had it. I appreciated those. I do agree that she brought some grit to the character that I wasn't expecting.
I think we associate Julie Walters with, like, a warmth underneath the toughness, and she, like, pointedly kept a lot of that warmth out of this that I found was an interesting choice in juxtaposition to what we're used to seeing her do.
Yeah. So worth it for the performances, not a great movie.
Yeah, I would say, you know, put it on in the background while you're doing other stuff at home.
Oh, the music's very good, though. Jesse Buckley can sing. Oh, my God.
Do you guys know that she started her career in a sort of, like, American Idol-like program in the UK?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I forget what the show was called, but it was when, because we had it here in America where they were casting the leads for Grease, the Grease I'm the One That I Want. But this was for Oliver, and she got second place.
Oh, yeah, for Nancy?
She didn't win.
Yeah.
Oh, to play Nancy? Okay.
Yeah, she did
not
win.
I could totally see her doing Nancy. Interesting.
So, yeah, and she's in Chernobyl. And she's just signed up to replace Brie Larson in the new what's that dude who did Synecdoche in New York called?
Charlie Kaufman.
In his new film. So she's going places.
Yeah.
Apparently, enough casting directors saw this movie and did not get annoyed by "Isn't She a Star That I Was Annoyed By?" and immediately cast her in everything.
Well, she, I forget what it's called, but she had some breakthrough in the UK a couple of years ago that I think she won some awards for.
That Beast?
Yeah, Beast. That's what it was called, yeah.
Need to catch up to that.
Yeah, so she's been on the rise for a couple of years.
She has risen.
Also, for people looking ahead to this year's Oscar race, this director also has another movie this year. It's the hot air balloon movie with Felicity Jones and Eddie Redmayne called The Aeronauts, if that doesn't, you know, make you all of your bones buckle.
Tom Harper is his name. Not to be confused with Tom Hooper.
Although they kind of look alike. They're both blonde British men who direct theater and TV. So...
so we will see.
Have you guys been seeing anything else lately?
I've honestly started my Almodovar rewatch because Criterion Channel just got a bunch of Almodovar movies, and I'm trying to catch other blind spots that they don't have. Mm-hmm. So in the past week, I've watched Matador and Law of Desire, and I will probably watch Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown today. So I'm doing an Almodovar rewatch.
Awesome. Have you ever seen What Have I Done to Deserve This?
No, not on Criterion Channel, but that might be one of the ones that I have to search for harder.
It's really good. It's really good. So look forward to that one. Okay. Law of Desire is my personal favorite Almodovar, so I hope you loved.
It's probably one of my least favorite that I've seen. But I understand why other people love it.
I just went to see the 30th anniversary of Do the Right Thing, which is being released in cinemas. So it is, it's a summer movie 30 years on, and that was great to see it in 35mm back on the big screen. It's great. So
that's so weird. I literally almost called you the other day and asked if you wanted to see it. I guess I missed out.
You did. I think it's still out for a couple more weeks, maybe.
Yeah.
It's a real missed repertory opportunity last year that there wasn't more rep screenings of Spike Lee's movies during Black Klansman.
Yeah, they should have been having whole, like, programs.
Anyway.
Yeah, I've been watching lots of TV, which has just happened sometimes, especially when movies... This has been a rough summer for movies. So I've been watching Stranger Things, which most people have, I'm sure. And lots of bad television, too, just on in the background, as Murtada states about Wild Rose.
What's your bad television du jour?
Oh, I am too embarrassed to admit to you guys what I watch, because I watched the whole season. Admittedly, I was not paying attention for most of it because it was terrible.
You're talking to somebody who watches Strange Addiction.
I will admit, I did the free week trial of DC Universe just out of curiosity, because I'm like, all of these streaming services are trying to make a buck, and I'm like, of course I'm canceling. Because it's terrible, their series are terrible, and they want you to pay, like, a Netflix price or whatever, and they have, like, three original series. I'm like,
wow.
What? And which reminds me of CBS All Access, that people are actually paying that. And they
we
only
were
have...
paying it because my husband's a Trekkie.
But it's just like, that's for just like one or two series. Like,
they had other like back catalog CBS stuff, but it wasn't stuff you couldn't find elsewhere necessarily.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. DC Universe has like all these like old DC movies, like the Superman movies and things, but it's like, it's really not a good deal. And so I watched the first season of Titans because I grew up reading that comic book, and it was just such bad television. I was ashamed I was watching it the whole time. So I just let it play in the background. I don't know. I'm not proud.
Is there anything you guys are looking forward to in the next couple of weeks? I guess Quentin Tarantino's coming our way.
I am excited for The Kitchen. I am very excited for The Kitchen. As we might be able to expect with those three stars in the movie, with Tiffany Haddish, Melissa McCarthy, and Elizabeth Moss. Yes, I'm very excited for that movie.
I have personally not watched the trailer for that because I want to go in fresh.
Very excited.
I'm looking to the forward to The Farewell, which I'm seeing tomorrow, finally.
Yes, I have no idea when I'm seeing that, but that opens this week in New York and Los Angeles, yes?
Yes, Friday. It is fantastic. I've seen it at Sundance. It's amazing. I can't wait to see it again. It's so fantastic.
Yeah, I'm seeing it tomorrow, and then Murtada and I are going to a farewell party.
Oh.
So hopefully Awkwafina will be there. who knows? You never know about these things. And I am actually really looking forward to the Tarantino, even though with trepidation, because I think he's been on a downward trajectory for a while. Because I did not like his last couple movies.
But you love Brad Pitt. At least there is that.
I do love
you.
Brad Pitt. I love. So I'm excited for that aspect. And also, I am so excited to see Mike Mo as Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm afraid his whole role is probably in the trailer. That's what I'm guessing. It's a very short performance.
Nothing in that movie can be as bad as The Hateful Eight. That's just not conceivable, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I doubt. Yeah, that was. I can't believe they released a 4.5-hour version. I'm like,
and I can't believe how many good reviews that got. But whatever. Bye, God.
You know, nobody got time for that. The GIF. Like, what the fuck? Anyway. So thank you so much for listening. Tell us in the comments what you thought of Midsommar and if you saw Wild Rose. And we will speak with you soon. And this is Murtada. And I've been here with...
Nathaniel.
And Chris.